Dzień dobry. Niecały miesiąc temu, recenzując na moim blogu książkę Firma, czyli ty, napisałem, że decyzja o byciu małą firmą wcale nie musi być tylko etapem przejściowym do czegoś większego, że może być celem samym w sobie i taką długoterminową strategią biznesową. Czy zastanawialiście się kiedyś, dlaczego tak wiele firm uznaje, że jedyną ścieżką ich rozwoju jest wzrost? Dlaczego walczą o to, aby kwartał za kwartałem były coraz lepsze pod względem wyników? I czy na pewno te zasady, którymi kierują się duże firmy notowane na giełdach, muszą być zastosowane także w przypadku małych firm? Czy nie istnieją przypadkiem inne wartości, które są dużo cenniejsze niż to, czy moja działalność gospodarcza z roku na rok będzie rosła? Od lat mi coś w tej koncepcji nie pasowało. Oczywiście jako inwestorowi, który kupuje akcje dużych firm, zależy mi na tym, aby one rosły. Ale już w mojej małej firmie oczekuję czegoś zupełnie innego. Chcę przede wszystkim, aby utrzymywała ona moją rodzinę, żebym mógł w niej pracować tak w sam raz, nie za dużo, nie za mało, bo wiem, że taki tryb pracy to jest jedyny tryb, który pozwoli mi czerpać radość z tego, co robię. I książka Firma, czyli ty, była dla mnie w pewnym sensie uwalniająca. Uwolniła mnie od takiej presji, że coś jest ze mną nie tak, że no, można powiedzieć, że dała mi przyzwolenie na to, aby prowadzić swoją firmę dokładnie według własnych zasad, żeby pozostać po prostu małym, bo jeśli się chce być małym, to dlaczego by nie pozostać małym, że nie muszę zatrudniać ludzi, zwłaszcza jeżeli się w tym nie odnajduję i nie chcę być też szefem dla moich pracowników. To książka, która bardzo u mnie rezonuje, ale jednocześnie zastanawiało mnie to, czy jej autor, czyli Paul Jarvis, mierzył się lub mierzy z podobnymi wątpliwościami co ja. Na ile ugruntowany jest u niego ten taki pogląd, że nie ma niczego złego w byciu małą, jednoosobową firmą i chęciu pozostania taką. Dlatego miałem olbrzymią przyjemność przepytać go właśnie pod tym kątem. Niestety nie obyło się bez problemów technicznych, więc z góry przepraszam was za jakość wideo z tej naszej rozmowy. Nieco kulis na temat tego, co się działo w odsłonie pod koniec tego podcastu, a teraz po prostu zapraszam do wysłuchania mojej rozmowy z Polem. Rozmowa jest w języku angielskim, ale jeżeli ktoś chce przeczytać jej tekstowe tłumaczenie na język polski, to zapraszam do mnie na bloga pod adres jakoszczędzaćpieniądze.pl/135. Good morning, Paul.
Hey, good morning. Or good evening for you.
Oh, good evening for me. Exactly. Good afternoon, actually. Yeah. We have a time difference here. Paul, you have written a great book, Company of One, which was just released in Poland as Firma, czyli ty, the company of one. And but before we go to the book itself, I would like to know what was your background. So basically, if you could quickly introduce yourself and tell about your previous business experiences, where all this started.
Sure. So I've worked for myself for 20 years now. It started in the 1990s when I became a web designer. So I was doing web design and online business consulting for clients, like big clients like Microsoft and Mercedes and entrepreneurs. And probably about 6 or 7 years ago, I started writing and making my own products like books and courses and software. And through that whole time, I've always been focused on not growing a large business. I like doing the work more than I like managing other people. So I never wanted to hire somebody to do the job I wanted to do and have to manage them. So the way that my business has always worked has been to keep it very small and contained and focus on making it better instead of making it bigger.
Okay, so what was the rationale behind not growing? Because it's quite opposite of mainstream, I would say.
Yeah, I think that I believe that the result of business success should be the freedom to choose what you want to do next instead of just having to grow. Because like I said, I don't want to have a big company where I have to manage other people. That to me, that wouldn't be success for me. And I think success is a very personal thing. So I would rather I would rather, if I'm in charge of the company, if it's my business, then I should be able to say how the business works and what I want to do and what I don't want to do. And for me, I've never wanted to have an office or have a commute to it or have a lot of employees. I've always just wanted to kind of do my own work, sit in my home office and get things done. And that to me feels like success. For other people, it might not. But for me, because it's my business, that's what feels right for me.
Okay, but were there any drawbacks of such approach to business? And didn't you have worries that you are really not a real businessman because you are not thinking about extending your business to the beyond of everyone's expectations?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. It's just a societal thing where people will tell you, oh, well, if you're not growing, you're dying, or you can't be a legitimate business person if you're in your pajamas in your home office. But I don't know. Like, I feel like I guess it just doesn't matter to me. I don't want to run a business for the perception of other people. I want to run a business that, one, makes profit because it's a business, it has to make money, and two, makes me feel like, okay, this is something that I actually want to do. Because running a business is hard, right? So I would rather run a business in a way that I want instead of, well, this looks good for other people. So, I mean, people, I guess in the beginning, people probably questioned me more, but because I've been doing this for so long and because I've done well with it, the questions have kind of fallen away. Because people see like, okay, well, he is actually doing well doing it this way. And so I'll have less questions about it.
Okay. But were you always such focused person and dedicated to the company of one model, or you evolved into this direction? Because, you know, when we start in business, we look for different influences and we try to model the companies which are already there. And I'm just thinking, because I'm working in exactly the same model. I mean, I'm the company of one. I'm not hiring anyone. My business is 6 years on the market right now. It's based purely on blog and my products. And of course, I had opportunities, many opportunities into growing into bigger company, hiring assistant, hiring people, which would probably help me do a lot more projects than I'm able to conduct right now. And I was really thinking very long about what are my priorities, and I was suspecting myself of cannibalizing my business, actually. So basically, that's the impact of the external world on my way of thinking. And I'm just trying to get into your head and see how that looked from your perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it has, I guess in the past, it was always a little tempting to grow, because especially when I was doing client work, I was always booked 6-10 months in advance. So if I had hired more people, I could have done more work, done more clients, made more money. But I think I always challenge that, and I haven't ever been tempted enough to take action to grow a bigger business, because it always came down to, for me, like, how do I want to spend my day? Right? Like, if I don't like managing other people and I grow a big business, then my day is going to be spent managing other people. And the thing about profitability too, is if I'm the only employee of my business, then, and my margins are low, then I can essentially make more money now than if I had employees and an office and overhead. So I think that we need to question the why. Like, why do we, if we want a big business, why do we want it? Do we want it because society tells us, well, you're not a legitimate business person unless you have a big business? Or do we want it because we actually do? There's some people who do like managing other people. And I'm glad that people like that exist, because it's not me. So I think it depends on the individual. And for me, growth has never made sense. So I've never wanted to grow.
Okay. So that I now know how do you work, but I'm thinking about whether this model, for what kind of companies this model is applicable. So if you could extend on the idea.
Yeah, I think it's applicable to a lot of businesses. I think the way that the internet and technology works now makes it easier to do things. I just think about 20 years ago, if somebody came to me and said, I want an e-commerce website, it would take probably 6 months to do that. You have to go to a bank, you have to get a special type of bank account in Canada and the States. And nowadays, I can just sign up for Shopify or a similar service in about 15 seconds, right? So I think that there's ways to do it. Yeah. Even in the book I talk, there's a lot of tech and digital companies because that's the background that I have, but there's even examples of companies like Peel who make iPhone cases. They're a company of probably 3 or 4 people, and they have a partner that does manufacturing for them, so they don't need to be a manufacturer. They have a company that fulfills orders, so they don't have to do that. So I think in working with the right partners and having the right people in your supply chain for whatever it is that you do, you can make it work. If you want to have a small business, then you can make it work for whether it's a physical product or a digital product or anything else. So I think there's ways to do it that way. If that's something that feels important to you, there's ways to do it regardless of what you do or sell.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that there are specific businesses, types of business that really can't be a company?
For sure.
One.
Amazon couldn't do that. Even something like Airbnb, yeah. Right? Like the Airbnb to work as a business model needs volume. So you can't have Airbnb and have one property for rent on it. The site wouldn't work. It has to have hundreds or thousands of properties in a lot of different cities. And so if being a company of one was important to me and I had a business idea to start a site like Airbnb, it wouldn't make sense, because in order for that to work, I would need to hire a lot of people. I would need to have a lot of critical mass. So I think before we start businesses, we need to think about, okay, what size of business would make sense for this business? And mm-hmm. for myself, if I'm starting a business and it would require that size or volume, that doesn't make sense. I shouldn't start a business like that. So I think it's important to think about it before, like what size does it, because the book and myself aren't anti-growth. I just think that we need to mm-hmm. think about growth as something that can be good, but isn't always good.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that there are many books on market about traditional business building and mm-hmm. scaling and increasing number of employees and revenues and so on. But there is not so many books about the alternatives. Yeah. And yeah, so that's the great example of why people should read this book, because it shows them the other way of doing the business. And I will get to a few ideas mentioned in the book. And one struck me very hard, because in chapter nine is called "Teach Everything You Know." I just wonder, why do you think it's so important to share all the information that in traditional businesses are really treated as the company secret, mm-hmm. yeah, and company knowledge, and are treated as the advantage against competitors and so on. And you say, teach everything you know.
Yeah, I think that it's important to consider that ideas aren't currency, execution is currency. And so me knowing, like, I know how Amazon works. It doesn't mean that I can go out and easily start another business like Amazon, right? It's so for all of the things that I know, for all of the things that I've experienced and that I've learned, it's okay if I share those with other people, because that's going to build trust. That's going to build the brand. That's going to build a relationship. Whereas if I thought everything that I knew was a secret and I held it in, nobody would know my expertise. Is just like me writing a book is in essence me sharing every single thing that I know on a topic. I didn't hold some things back as secrets because I wanted to profit above other people. So I think that it's important to think about ideas as a way to build attention and a way to build trust and a way to build community and audience, because those ideas don't even mean that much. It's how you execute on them. I could show you how to write a book, and it doesn't mean you're going to write the exact same book as me. I could show you how to build an online course. It doesn't mean you're going to have the same course. And even if you had a similar course, just because one thing exists in the market doesn't mean that nothing else can exist. I think markets exist where there is competition. I teach a freelancing course. There's thousands of freelancing courses. It doesn't mean that one takes away from the other. The market is so big that people are going to be, some are going to be drawn to what I have to say. Some are going to be drawn to what other people have to say. And it's funny, I did a survey a couple years ago now with my audience, and it was mostly people who bought from me. And I asked them, why did you buy from me? Like, why did you buy my business book when there's thousands of other business books? Why did you buy my software when there's so many other things that are similar? And they said, it's because you're the one who created it. You're the one who I trust. And they only trust me, and they only want to pay attention to me because I just freely share all of the information that I have, all of the knowledge that I have, all the experience that I have. And I do so all the time. I'm a mailing list called the Sunday Dispatches. So I send an email with an article in it every Sunday. I've done that for 6 years. And that's where I share all of the things that I know. And it's never harmed my business. It's never made me make less money because I share all the things that I know. In essence, it's the reverse. I make a lot more money because I share all of the things that I know.
Do you think that it's easy to build such trust right now?
Yes and no. I think that patience is required. Like my audience, I've sent out an email once a week for 7 years, and I've never missed a Sunday. So that kind of consistency and cadence builds trust, right? Because I have something that people find valuable, which I didn't know until I started sharing was valuable, people didn't start paying attention, right? Because I share my honest, unfiltered opinion about things, people, even if they disagree, they trust what I have to say. And I think having a point of view, having an opinion, having a strong perspective on something can push some people away, but it can also draw the right people closer to you, where people will trust you a little more. So I think it's hard to build an audience. Like I fully agree, especially nowadays, it's a lot, the market is saturated, but it doesn't mean that it's impossible. It doesn't mean that everybody else should just be like, oh, there's enough influencers in the world, there are enough thought leaders, like I'm just not even gonna try. There's always room for more, and there's always room for new ideas and perspectives.
I'm just wondering, because that's my way of operating is comparable to yours. I mean, I have the same objectives, and I also make very transparent articles where I publish all the information I have. I'm showing the background of my work and so on. And people get excited, more and more excited, the more I share. Yeah, so basically, that's the way the trust is built on my side. But on the other hand, sometimes I'm just questioning my authority, because I know that many people, more and more people follows me, and basically I'm questioning whether I am really the good source of information, the best source of information for them. Yeah, and I would say it's when you set the bar very, very high for yourself, and it's more and more difficult to jump over, yeah, basically, because you know that there are one thing are people expectations, and then the second thing is that I try to be responsible, yeah, for what I do, and basically sometimes make me wondering whether I'm really delivering the top-notch content at the moment. Yeah, so
yeah,
and I'm just wondering, whether do you have such thoughts, I would say?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that it's good to have a little bit of self-doubt. I think that that can kind of offset the hubris or ego that we kind of need to have to share things publicly. So I think having that, and I think that it's what you said, I think is extremely smart and important to consider the consequences of what you share. And it's something that I think about as well, is if I'm going to share this take on this topic, what can people do with it that may be good or maybe bad, right? So but, I want to make sure that the things that I'm sharing, and there's some topics that I won't write about because I don't know the consequences of people taking, saying like, okay, I trust Paul, I'm going to do what he says here. I don't want that to ever harm somebody. So I'm not going to write about certain things. So I think having that bit of self-doubt, I think, is important. And I think the other thing is that a lot of people who aren't sharing currently feel like they can't share until they reach a certain point. And I think that that point is sometimes unattainable, where I'm not sharing because I know everything. You're not sharing because you know everything. We're just sharing things that we know, and we're sharing where we are at and our journey currently. Like, just because you don't have to know everything to be an expert or an authority. You just have to know some things and be honest about what you know and what you don't know. So I would never call myself an expert at any topic, but I'm happy to share the things that I know, and even they can change. Like, some things I wrote 6-7 years ago, I disagree with now, and that's totally okay. Like, I've grown as a person. How small-minded of a person would you have to be to just never change your mind about anything if new facts were presented?
Exactly. I'm wondering whether do you change some of your opinions or view on topics since writing of The Company of One? Are there any things that you would written other way right now?
For sure. I talked about the Facebook like button in a positive light, and I actually think the Facebook like button is responsible for a lot of bad things in the world.
Yeah.
I also think that, and it was unintentional on my part, but I didn't write strongly enough about freelancing being a valid way to be a company of one. I kind of glossed over client services right into products. And I think that that was a disservice, both to my own experience, because I was a freelancer doing client work far longer than I've been a product person. And I think that I probably should have talked about how you can be a company of one as a freelancer or as somebody who provides services to other people. So if I could go back and change those parts, I definitely would. I've written articles about why I was wrong in the book on my website, but in the book, it's still the way that it is, because you can't change an entire book. So
yeah, exactly. Okay, so freelancing is an example of topic not covered enough in the book or skipped in the book. And do you have any idea why have you skipped this topic at the moment of writing?
Yeah, I think it's just because what I do now is I haven't done client work or freelancing for probably 6 or 7 years, so it just wasn't. Like, when I was writing the book, I was thinking, okay, like, what can I share about where I'm at now instead of what can I share based on all of my experiences? So it was unintentional, but I do wish I had done that a bit differently.
Yeah. In the book, you mentioned several features that the people who would like to be the company of one business owners should have. If you could elaborate on them. I mean, what are the most required characteristics of such people?
Yeah, I think the first one and the most important one is resilience. And there's been studies done that show having resilience as a human being is more useful than education or training or experience. There's a study done by Dean Becker, and there's three parts of resilience. The first is accepting reality, because we can't control everything. We just have to roll with the punches a lot of the time. The second is having a sense of purpose or a sense of a greater good. So even if things go wrong, you still have that purpose to move towards and make progress towards. And then the third thing is the ability to adapt, because things change constantly. Consumer sentiment changes, technology changes, everything's changed. I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years. It's a lot different now than it was 20 years ago. And we have to have the ability to reinvent and adapt and stay true to our purpose. So I think resilience is the number one trait for a company of one. Some of the other ones are, let me just try to remember, autonomy. So being able to master something and then be able to give yourself direction in the work. Being able to work quickly. I think part of the benefits of being a small business is that you can get things done without having to have 18 meetings about it, or get board approval, or get investor approval. If you can move quickly and get work done and iterate on problems and try to make them as good as possible, then that's really good. And then the next thing is simplicity. And simplicity doesn't mean ease. I think it's very difficult to have a simple business. But if you can come up with things in your business that are, say, simple rules, simple processes, simple systems, then if you take the time to set those simple things up, which does take a lot of time, then it can be faster to move forward, faster to execute on ideas. And I think a lot of times we solve problems by adding more to them. And that's not always, it's easier to do that, but it's rarely better to do that.
Can you give the examples of things
Sure.
that you simplified in your business?
Sure. So thinking about things like, say, for a software product, if my company is getting a lot of support requests, the easiest way to solve for that is to hire a support person or another support person to build the team. But
yeah.
the way to simplify that is to think about, okay, what are the problems that people are coming to me with? How can I make the software better so they ask less questions? How can I make the onboarding better so they understand how to use the software faster? How can I provide, say, tutorial videos or articles or something so they can understand without having to get in touch with support in the first place? So all of those things would simplify, but they wouldn't be adding more to the problem. They wouldn't be solving the problem with more support people. They'd be solving the problem with a simpler way to achieve less support communication, right? So doing things like that, I think, are really important. But because they take a lot of work and a lot of thinking and a lot of problem solving, people are just like, oh, I'll just hire another support staff.
Yeah. If you could compare the companies of one versus bigger companies, what kind of advantages do you see in staying small?
Yeah, I think the larger you get, the less freedom you have. Like you end up, mm-hmm. as you build a big business, you end up having to make decisions, not because you want to, but just because the size of the snowball rolling down the hill is now this big, right? So you end up having to make decisions that appease investors or appease a board of directors or appease the rest of the C-suite. So I think that in having a smaller business, you can make decisions that are best for your customers, which always seems like a good idea to me, and best for the type of business you want to run. And like I said at the beginning of our conversation, I think that having success in business doesn't mean you necessarily need to grow your business. It means that you now have the freedom to decide what growth makes sense and what growth doesn't make sense. Because a lot of times growth comes with a lot of obligation, right? And I don't want mm-hmm. to, I want to be free from obligation and stress as much as possible. So I want to enjoy my life, and I want to run a business that supports my life instead of having a life that solely exists to support my business.
So how does this apply to Paul Jarvis' life? I mean, how do you structure your life? What's the priority for you right now when you have the company of one?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely like to work hard to get the work done. But I think for me, I work hard so I can finish the work. A lot of people work hard so they can pile more on their plate.
Okay.
And so I work probably 4 to 6 hours a day. That's it. I don't feel like I need to work more hours than that. And I feel like if I give myself that constraint, I can be more productive. Because if I give myself 16 hours to work, I'm going to be working a bit. I'm going to be on YouTube a bit. I'm going to be on Twitter a bit. But if I give myself just a smaller amount of time every day, then I can get the work done. I don't feel burnt out or stressed out all of the time. And it just... Mm-hmm. I have other aspects of my life that I enjoy. So I want to have a business that also lets me enjoy the other aspects of my life and my hobbies and my interests.
That's great. That's great. I'm interested in your opinion about the hustle way of living. I mean, there are people who are pushing all the time, who are trying to make look them busy, look them being in the process all the time, working all the time, being available to the others all the time. And I'm just wondering, what's your opinion on that? That's the first thing. And the second thing, how if you have a different approach, then my question is, okay, how do you handle customer requests, for example?
Yeah, so I think that hustle culture is like Soviet style propaganda, to be honest. Like, it seems both useless and also harmful. I think it's propagated by people who benefit from workers working harder. So people like Elon mm-hmm. Musk obviously is going to encourage hustling because he benefits. His workers don't benefit if they work harder. He does, right? Same with Marissa Mayer, yeah. I don't think she's CEO anymore of Yahoo, when she had that famous speech talking about how you have to work hard. And Elon Musk says that you can't make a difference unless you're working like more than 80 hours a week. And he has a couch in his office because he doesn't have time to go home and yeah. see his family so he can sleep on it. I have a couch in my office for napping and reading. So I think that the whole hustle culture is misguided. I think that productivity is good, but I think productivity should be trying to get your work done in an efficient way so you no longer have to work. I should be rewarded if I can get 8 hours of work done in four. I shouldn't have 200% more work because I got it done in half the time. And so I think the people at the top encourage this, and rightfully so, because it helps them make more money. It lines their coffers. If what's his name? Yeah. Jeff Bezos has the people in their fulfillment centers have these little scanners that tell them how long it should take them to walk from one end of the factory to the other to pick up an order. And they have to be as efficient and hustle as hard as possible. And he's worth like $120 billion and they make $15 an hour. Like, I think it's exploitive to perpetuate this like rise and grind hustle culture, because it only benefits the people at the top. Even if you work for yourself, it doesn't benefit you because you're eventually going to burn out or stress out or not enjoy your life. What was the second part of the question? I forgot now because I got off on a tangent on the first part.
Okay, so if you are not hustling, yeah. then the question is, pushing all the time, being available all the time, the question is, how do you organize customer support? How do you serve customers if they have urgent needs? Yeah, for example.
Yeah, so I would never start a business that would require a lot of scale and mass. Like, I would never start an Airbnb. I would also never start a business that had mission critical things. Mm-hmm. So I would never start a business that required me to be available 24/7. That sounds like a nightmare of a business to run. Like, I personally wouldn't want to wait. If it's 3 a.m, if it's 11 o'clock at night, I'm asleep already. I don't want to be woken up. So all of the businesses that I run don't require urgent support. The first thing I do in the morning is I wake up and I clear out the support queue for the products that I own. Mm-hmm. I think that having good customer support is absolutely necessary, and treating customers like they're the most important people, more important than leads, is very important. And I care a lot about that. And I care about making things right with customers if things go wrong. But I'm going to do that once a day. I'm going to get back to people within 24 hours. I think that that's reasonable and humane to have that kind of limit, as opposed to I'm going to reply to you within 15 minutes, day or night. Yeah. I'd like that. I wouldn't be able to run my business very well if I offered that to people. It wouldn't benefit them and it wouldn't benefit me. But if the first thing I do is customer support every single day, it's totally manageable, totally humane. And nobody's complained about it. Nothing. And like I said, nothing I do is so mission critical that their house could be burning down and I reply the next morning. Like, none of the things I offer need that level of support.
Yeah. You set the expectations, and your customers know what is the maximum time they will wait for the answer. So basically, you are exactly. honest. Yeah, with your customer support. Yeah, in the book Company of One, you mention MVPR, but it's not minimum viable product, but minimum viable profit. Could you please elaborate on the idea?
Yeah, so I think that if we consider how much money we need to make to be profitable as a business, we can work backwards from that. So if we think about like an example business, if you need to make, say, $1,000 a month, but you have $2,000 of expenses, you're going to have to make a lot more than that to reach that. But if you have a lot less, and which is why in the book I talk a lot about minimizing the expenses we have and increasing margins, because if we have less expenses and higher margins, we can become profitable sooner. And then we don't have to worry about all of this growth if we minimize the bottom line in the business. And I think that a lot of times we become obsessed with the gross number, the gross revenue, but the gross revenue doesn't typically tell the whole story. Yeah. If it costs you $900,000 to make $1 million a month, then you're not really making $1 million a month in profit. You're making $100,000. I would rather figure out a way to spend, say, $10,000 and make $200,000 a month, and then I'm making a whole lot more money than if I was spending $900 and only making $1 million. So I think in considering, like, what's the minimum amount that I need to spend to keep my business operational? What's the minimum amount I need to make my margins where they're at? And then we can think about, okay, if it costs me $1,000 a month in expenses, then if I make $2,000 a month, I'm technically making $1,000 profit. If I was spending $2,000 and making $2,000, I'd just be breaking even. So I think in thinking about the minimum amount that we need to make instead of the maximum amount, then we can start to say, like, okay, well, this is, like, this is a good business expense, or this is not, or maybe I don't need to have an office. If I'm running a digital business, maybe I don't need to pay rent on an office and pay for another phone line, another internet, a fax machine. I don't know if people still buy fax machines, but like, if we can figure out a way to minimize all of the expenses that we have, then we become profitable sooner every month or every year. And I think that that's really important when we're considering that if we're adopting the Company of One mindset, we're not solving every problem by adding more into the solution. If we're solving it by optimizing for things like expenses or increasing margins, then we don't need to grow as much to have as much.
Paul, I was also wondering, how do you prioritize your projects? I mean, probably you have to take into consideration that you have no human resources available. And I'm just wondering about your process of selecting what you will do.
Yeah. So I definitely, like I said, I would never want to select something that would require a lot of scale to work. I would never select something that would be mission critical, where I would have to be available 24/7. I also look for projects that I can do with either the skill set I have or the skill set that I can have with myself and a business partner, which probably half of the products that I sell, I have a business partner, a different business partner for each with. And I always like to do things one at a time. I don't think that I could do things where I have to work on like 8 different things in a day. So I typically prioritize like a week or a month of work on a specific thing. So if I'm writing a book, I'm not writing a book, releasing a new version of software, updating a course, and doing like 16 other things. If I'm writing a book, then I have 2 or 3 months to write the book. If I'm working on a new version of software, then I'm just working on that. And so I kind of do things in a sequence as opposed to all of the things all at the same time. I feel like that would be very stressful, and I don't think I'm smart enough to do
to
it
handle
that way.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So can you tell me how many new projects do you take or conduct every year?
Usually One at the most. Like, I last year was Company of One, the book. This year is Fathom Analytics. The courses I've taught for years. It's not very many. Like, I do so few things because all of the things that I do at this point require a lot of work, but they also require a lot of maintenance. So I know that if I'm releasing a book, I'm going to have to do hundreds of interviews. So me finishing writing the book isn't the finish line for me. It's probably about 40% of the way of the progress. Yeah. Same with software. I know that if I'm going to release a new version of software, I'm going to have to start promoting it. I'm going to have to start, there's probably going to be more support requests because there's new features. There's always going to be things that cascade past the point of what some people would think, okay, this is the finish line. It's typically, you're only about halfway done the race. There's still so many more things. So I always try to consider the obligation or the maintenance costs of the opportunities that I take on, because every opportunity has an associated maintenance cost to it. Right. So I take on very few things. I say no to most things, and because I don't want to have more than I can handle.
Okay. And about saying no to things, do you have a review project, review process for the projects that you have taken on? I mean, are there projects that you, for example, cancel during the project because you realize that they are taking too much time, or you have not estimated the effort required proper way?
I have canceled more products than I currently have active, because things sometimes, there's unintended consequences sometimes for decisions that you make, and you can't be aware of them, unfortunately, until after. I had a business that was selling minimal WordPress themes for a while, and it was profitable, but it required so much support. Half my day was taken up with support requests. And it just wasn't, I hated it, to be honest. Like, it wasn't fun that I couldn't be creating things. I just had to be supporting things. So I shut it down. I've sold 2 software businesses, possibly a third, in the last 2 years, because I was the right person to make the product. I'm not the right person to operate the product long term. So I'm happy to sell things or cancel things if they're no longer working for me or no longer working for customers.
Mm-hmm. How does that process in your head look like? I mean, how do you validate whether it's worth to pursue the project or just cancel it?
Yeah, I mean, it has to be profitable. If it's not profitable, I'm going to shut it down because it's a business, not a hobby. So it needs to make money. Yeah, to make money, because if a business is making money, then it's sustainable. Businesses don't shut down because they're too profitable. They shut down for other reasons. So profit first has to be the first thing. The second thing is how it's affecting my time and my life outside of work. If it's something I'm thinking about and stressing about, even when I'm not working, I don't want to do it anymore. Like, that's just too much of a mental load for me if I'm worried about it, even if I'm not working. And it also has to be able to, because of the way that I work, where I work in sequence, where I'm working on one specific thing for a little bit of time, if the project requires me to jump in and do work in that time where it should be dedicated to something else, I'm probably going to not want to do it. So, which is why I like things like books. It's, you can do it as one person, as a writer. You can write the book. You can spend your time writing and then promoting, and then you don't have to do as much of it as time goes on, and you can write another book. And so things like that, for the type of life that I want, for the way that I like to operate, make a lot of sense. Like, there's no mystery or just happenstance. All of the things that I do, I've been very intentional about. I'm doing these things for a reason, not just because I felt like them or that seemed like a good idea. All of the products that I sell, all the ways that I make money, has been very intentional to stick with the Company of One mindset that I like and and how I operate and what works for the business that I have and how I want to run it.
Do you consider yourself a lazy person or rather workaholic?
I think I'm somewhere in the middle, because I do, like, I work because it's work, not because I love the work. I work because it's something that I do that makes money and that helps other people. And so, but definitely, like, if I can, if I'm done my work and I just want to sit on the couch and watch TV or go to my garden or go for a bike ride, I'd rather be doing those things most of the time. But I know that in order to live the life that I want, I need to do some work as well. So I am pretty driven with, I do like to create things. I do like to put things out into the world and release them, but I'm not going to kill myself and hustle too hard to put them out. So I think I'm somewhere in between where I'm driven enough where I've worked for myself for so long that I'm motivated internally. I don't need somebody else to tell me what to do to get it done because my entire adult life has been working for myself, but I'm also not going to bust my butt to do things and put every and forsake everything else in my life to do them.
Do you think that you will be working even if you would take the money out of equation?
Maybe. I've thought about that, and I've thought about, like, okay, I can retire at some point soon because I'll have enough in savings, but I just don't know what that would look like. Like, I honestly don't know what not having work for a bit of every day would look like. That'll probably change as I get older, but I don't know. The work is meaningful to me, and it does serve a greater purpose for me, so I like doing it. I would probably just work less, I guess, if I reached my financial goals, but I still like working a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't like working. I like the point at which something is ready to release into the world.
Yeah, yeah. The result of the work. Yeah. And the way that people react of seeing your or using your product and so on. Yeah. The reason I'm asking the question is because based on our talk, I see that you are kind of person that already knows what would like to do in his life, and you are already doing it. So basically, I was at the point because I'm actually financially free person. So basically, I found myself in a point where I have to decide, okay, what is the reason why I should be working more and more, yeah? And after that point. And I realized that money is only a small fraction of the equation. And you said the other part is you like to create, and probably as the creator, you like to see how your art, I would say, is accepted by others. And I realized that's what drives me, basically. Yeah, I like to do the work. And I felt that I actually spent some time not working, and it was quite a long time, over a year. And I realized it doesn't make me happy. I mean, yeah, I thought that after reaching the goal, I will be playing the games and spending time with my family all the time, and it was my dream. Yeah. And then I realized, sorry, reality looks the other way.
Exactly. So. Done the same where if I take 3 or 4 months off, I'm itching to get back to work. And then if I work for too long, I'm itching to not work. So I think there does need to be like a bit of a balance there.
Okay. So to close our talk, I would like to ask you, why do you think what are the reasons that most companies really desire the growth and go this path?
I think it's ego. Like, I think that in the beginning, you need ego to start something because you need the ego to say, what I want to put into the market doesn't exist, but it should. And so I think ego in that case is good because it's very helpful. Yeah. But I think at some point, the growth just serves our ego as opposed to our needs or the needs of our customers. And I think that societal perception is a much bigger thing than we give it credit for, because we see that, okay, well, the way that capitalism works is you grow and you defeat your competition and you take over a market and you have investors and you have a board of directors and you go public. And nobody really stops and says, like, should I do that? Like, is this going to benefit me? Is this going to benefit my customers in some way? And I don't care. Like, if somebody thinks that, oh, Paul, you don't have a legitimate business, you have a lifestyle business, I'm like, cool. That's great. I make a ton of money. I like my work. I don't have to work too hard. It's if that's a lifestyle business and I have an amazing lifestyle business, because I think every business is a lifestyle business. I think if you run or work at a huge company, you have a very specific lifestyle that's prescribed to you by that type of business. I would rather have the type of lifestyle that I want to have based on the business I have, as opposed to just, well, your business is this big, this is the life that you get because you have a big business. So yeah, I think a lot of it's social perception, but I think that we can change that, or we can buck that and not have to prescribe to that just because it looks good to other people.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Good closing point. Paul, if people would like to find more about you, about what you do, where they should look for the information?
Sure. My website, pjrvs.com, or if you Google Paul Jarvis, like I said, my newsletter, I write it every week. And that's the best place to keep up with the things that I do. And also check out the book Company of One, which is available in Polish, which is awesome.
Yeah. Firma Czelite in Polish, yeah. And that's it was great to talk to you, man. Thank you very much.
This is a great conversation.
Thank you. No i to już koniec. Jeśli spodobała ci się rozmowa z Polem, to bardzo mocno zachęcam do lektury książki Firma Czelite. Można ją kupić w moim sklepie internetowym na stronie jakoszczędzaćpieniądze.pl/sklep. A w notatkach do tego odcinka podcastu, przypominam, pod adresem jakoszczędzaćpieniądze.pl/135 znajdzie się także link do mojej recenzji tej książki. I na koniec mam taką małą wskazówkę. Jeśli kiedykolwiek, podobnie jak ja, będziecie się umawiać na tego typu rozmowy pomiędzy rozmówcami, którzy są zlokalizowani w kilku strefach czasowych, to nie ufajcie internetowym takim stronom, które przeliczają czas, bo no rzeczywiście popełniłem ten błąd. I niestety te strony również mają swoje błędy i błędnie dokonują takich konwersji. Niestety przy nagrywaniu tej rozmowy doszło właśnie do takiej pomyłki. W efekcie nagrywałem ją w dużym pośpiechu. Nie byłem wystarczająco dobrze przygotowany jeszcze do tej rozmowy, bo zaistniała ona godzinę wcześniej niż planowany czas. I można powiedzieć, że przez tą moją pomyłkę doszło do tego, że w zasadzie przez całą rozmowę nawet nie miałem jak spojrzeć na pytania, które sobie zanotowałem do Pola. Nie zdążyłem ustawić kamery, która by kręciła mnie, i w efekcie ten obraz jest taki szarpany, bo był nagrywany kamerką internetową przez Skype'a wyłącznie. No więc, no cóż, nawet Michał Szafrański popełnia takie błędy i też mi się takie problemy przytrafiają. No a później cała rozmowa jest, można powiedzieć, w dużej mierze improwizowana. I pewnie dlatego też widać w tej rozmowie trochę moje zdenerwowanie, bo nie dość, że po angielsku, nie dość, że z osobą, którą bardzo cenię, to jeszcze wyszło na to, że po prostu mega, mega nieprofesjonalnie się zachowałem w stosunku do Pola. On oczywiście był rozbawiony tym faktem, ale to nie zmienia postaci rzeczy, że mogła być to jeszcze fajniejsza i lepsza rozmowa, bo kilku pytań, które planowałem mu zadać, po prostu mu nie zadałem, gdzieś tam uciekły z głowy. Ale niemniej jednak mam nadzieję, że mimo wszystko była to rozmowa dla ciebie wartościowa. No i to w zasadzie już tyle na dzisiaj. Także z jednej strony trochę przepraszając, ale z drugiej bardzo ci mocno dziękuję za ten wspólnie spędzony czas i życzę ci skutecznego przenoszenia twoich celów finansowych na wyższy poziom. Trzymaj się, do usłyszenia.